You can meet and hear Anthony Esalen, John Warwick Montgomery, Ryan Anderson, Bev Yonke, Mark Kaltoff, and Chris Rosebro at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Issuesetc.org.
None of these allegations are true.
Correct.
No doubt in your mind.
Zero. I'm 100% certain.
You swear to God.
I swear to God.
The problem is not that Islam isn't a religion. The problem is that it is a bad religion.
Feminism is just horrific. Everything it does as a philosophy is counter to the Bible. It makes the individual the foundation of society rather than the family, and that's completely against the biblical order.
In my particular life, one way he has helped me, one way he has kept me on the path of righteousness is he has given me suffering. This suffering returns me to the Good Shepherd.
East Africa LCMS missionaries love Issues Etc., especially on demand. Bwana Yesu Asifiwe.
When we call the U.S. Constitution a limiting document, what does that mean? What is it limiting? How does it limit in this case, the powers of the federal government? Does it have any effect on the powers of state governments? A lot of these things, educating ourselves in the U.S. Constitution, our system of government, seems very pressing nowadays. Questions as simple as, why do we have a First Amendment, those basic first freedoms enumerated and recognized in the Bill of Rights? Why do we have a Bill of Rights that wasn't part of the original Constitution, but was almost kind of a guarantee that the Constitution would get ratified? And did you happen to know that there were originally 17 amendments that were whittled down to 12 and then down to the 10 that we know as the Bill of Rights? It's going to be part three of our series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dahn. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday afternoon, October the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll be talking about enumerated powers, federalism, and the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution that is known as the Bill of Rights and its importance. A little bit later, listener email, the Issues Etc. comment line. Then Heather Roush will join us to talk about a culture of sexual integrity. Joining us for part three of our series on the U.S. Constitution, as we discuss enumerated powers, federalism, and the Bill of Rights, Dr. Russell Dahn, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dahn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
What do you think the framers would make of the situation in our nation's capital if they could have kind of tuned into cable TV and social media coming out of Washington over the last month?
It's hard to imagine they'd have thought anything other than what a mess and where to start, really. The misunderstandings of our constitutional structure, the lack of concern for due process, maybe most fundamentally the lack of reason, the focus mainly on emotions rather than reason, on feelings rather than evidence. I wonder if they would have wondered whether we were a virtuous enough people to govern ourselves, because it doesn't appear that we're capable of governing ourselves based on not just Washington, D.C., but the reactions around the country.
In that vein, before we get into the topics at hand, that raises a very important question, which is, and I think I'm right in assuming, that for the framers, the Constitution that they were crafting had as one of its basic assumptions that the people were going to be a virtuous people and that they were going to elect, in essence, virtuous representatives.
Yes. Now, they didn't assume that that would happen as a matter of course. So next week, we'll talk in some more detail about this. But they built in some structures to try to help ensure that the right kinds of people, meaning virtuous, at least in an earthly sense, virtuous people, would be the ones elected. And they also built in safeguards against the mob, if you will, against the tyranny of the majority, because they knew that was a tendency as well. But they also had this optimistic understanding that people can be virtuous enough to govern themselves and to make wise and reasonable decisions for the good of the whole, rather than purely emotional, selfish decisions.
Turning to the topic proper, why don't you bring us up to speed with a little bit of a review of where we've been so far in this series on the U.S. Constitution before we talk about enumerated powers?
Sure. Well, last time we completed our discussion of the origins of the Constitution, and we explored the specific context in which the Constitution was drafted and adopted. So the failures of the Articles of Confederation through the 1780s, the overreach, really, of the Philadelphia Convention, which had been called to amend the Articles of Confederation, not to draft a new Constitution. And then the concerns of the Anti-Federalists and the battles over ratification of the Constitution.
When we talk about enumerated powers, we return to the basic theme that the Constitution is, in large part, a limiting document. Describe that idea.
Sure. Well, the idea behind the Constitution is that governing powers were delegated by the states. The people had the right to govern themselves, and then the people had been organized into states, basically the descendants of the colonies, if you will, and those states held the governing power. In order for there to be a central or national government over the states, those powers from the states had to be delegated to the federal authority, to the central authority. And so that's what's going on in the U.S. Constitution, is a delegation of powers away from the states to the national government.
So we're looking at this document as the states together with its ratification saying, we have these powers properly as individual states. We are delegating these powers to the central government, to the federal government. To what end? For what purpose?
Well, the main purposes for the central government were to promote commerce, especially with foreign nations, trade, basically, for common defense, and for internal cohesion, because with these states each being sovereign in themselves, you know, they could have had trade conflicts or even gone to war with one another because they were independent of one another. So part of the idea of the federal government was to avoid that sort of conflict between states.
In the preamble to the Constitution, they are kind of drawing a big picture of what kind of powers they want to enumerate, or what the goals they want to accomplish with delegating power to the federal government. And they start with an idea of domestic tranquility. What would that have meant to the framers?
Well, probably they were thinking about some of the difficulties that had arisen during the 1780s under the Articles of Confederation that the central government was not capable of handling, because the Articles of Confederation did not create a strong enough central government. So uprisings such as Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts that were a result of economic difficulties and disagreements over property rights, those sorts of things needed to be quelled. Those sort of things needed to not arise in the first place. And I think that's probably what they had in mind with domestic tranquility.
They speak of establishing justice. Is that something as narrow as having a system of courts at the federal level that could address the legal issues that arise from the states?
No, I think more they had in mind something along the lines of John Locke's thought of the preservation of property. And by property, John Locke meant our lives and our liberty, as well as our land and our goods. And so establishing justice would be that people would not be deprived of these things randomly or unfairly.
The notion of the general welfare, what is that?
That is a highly debated concept, honestly. So today, of course, we think of this as trying to create equality of outcomes, that the general welfare means everyone is reaping the benefits of the good of society, the wealth of society, if you will. And I suppose there's a degree of that going on in those days as well. Nobody wanted to see people starving or that sort of thing. But more, it was, remember the word is promote the general welfare. So rather than having government create general welfare, that people would be in a good state of affairs because of what the government is doing for them, rather it would be that the government creates a context in which people can find their own general welfare and create their own general welfare through their families and their businesses and their churches.
And providing for the common defense, did they picture kind of a standing militia or army? Or was that simply, we're not going to go to war with each other, and if anyone goes to war with one of us, they go to war with all of us?
It is more the latter. They weren't, a standing army was still viewed as a sign of tyranny. So for them, it's this militia system that needed interaction, that needed intercoordination. Each state fighting independently would not have been nearly as effective as all of the states together being coordinated in their actions and in their goals.
And then finally, in that vein, along the lines of the kind of general purpose in the preamble there, the language gets kind of high-flown, promote the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. It's beautiful.
Yes.
But what does it mean?
Well, the colonists, now new country, had enjoyed liberty in the sense of self-governance and a lack of tyranny, at least a relative lack of tyranny, for generations, to an extent that most people groups on Earth had never enjoyed. And because of that liberty, and because they were effective at governing themselves, they had found a good deal of prosperity, a good deal of comfort. Taking into account the lack of technology, they really had accomplished quite a lot in terms of comfort for a pre-modern era. So they wanted to continue that. They wanted to keep it for themselves, and they believed it was a gift from God that they had liberty and the blessings that come with that, and they wanted to preserve it for those who come after them.
We're talking with Dr. Russell Dawn, director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. It's our series on the U.S. Constitution today, Enumerated Powers, Federalism, and the Bill of Rights. We'll talk about some adjectives necessary and proper after this.
With Western man, there's no going back behind Christ. It's either Christ or it's nothing at all. If it's nothing at all, then he ceases to have any culture or any civilization, properly speaking. His civilization comes to an end.
Dr. Anthony Eslin, author of the best-selling book Out of the Ashes, talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
But for Western man to know Christ and then to turn away from him, to have his whole civilization built upon the Christian faith and then to turn away from that, is suicide.
You can meet and hear Dr. Anthony Eslin making the case for Western civilization at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Attendance is limited to 400. Child care is free. You'll find a conference schedule and you can register at issuesetc.org.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
The Lord is our shepherd, and we are the people of his pasture. Why then do we still suffer in this life? Disease, loneliness, persecution. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm collaborating with Cheryl Swope, Molly Hemingway, and a host of literary friends in He Restores My Soul, a book that takes an honest look at hardship and heartache in light of God's promises found in his word. He Restores My Soul is now available at emmanuelpress.us, emmanuelpress.us.
Well, Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. Russell Dawn. Our series on the U.S. Constitution continues today. We're talking about enumerated powers, federalism, and the Bill of Rights. Dr. Dawn, getting into a couple of the clauses in Article 1 of the Constitution, they use adjectives like necessary and proper when they're speaking of these enumerated powers. How will you explain that?
The necessary and proper clause is found in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which is setting forth the powers of Congress. Congress has the power to do these enumerated things. And the necessary and proper clause says that it also has the power, in addition to these enumerated powers, these delegated powers delegated from the states, Congress also has the proper to make all laws that are necessary and proper to carry into effect these enumerated powers. So yes, they have the power to tax and to spend and et cetera, everything there in Article 1, Section 8. And then they have the power to pass the laws to put these things into effect that make them work. These are sort of broad categories in these enumerated powers. So Congress is naturally going to have to get into the details and pass laws regarding the details. So the necessary and proper clause gives them the power to do that. It also gives Congress the power to pass laws regarding the details for any other powers granted to the federal government in the Constitution. So, for instance, the executive power includes the power of making treaties. But Congress, through the Necessary and Proper Clause, makes laws that puts those treaties into effect within the United States. So that's giving Congress power that actually touches on the executive power. Likewise, Congress has the power to pass laws to organize the courts, because the federal government has the power to create courts, and so they get organized by Congress.
What would you say about the General Welfare Clause?
Along with the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Welfare Clause was one of the more controversial ones between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists viewed these clauses as granting Congress unbounded power. As it turns out, they really haven't been used that way, and that wasn't the intent, at least according to drafter James Madison. So for the General Welfare Clause, it's related specifically to the taxing and spending powers, that Congress can lay taxes to pay the expenses incurred for the sake of the general welfare of the people. So it's related specifically to taxing and spending power, not just to legislate anything they want for the sake of the general welfare. Rather, it is specifically tied to taxing and spending. In addition, that power is roughly a carryover from the Articles of Confederation. So where the Anti-Federalists are deeply concerned about the General Welfare Clause, something similar to it was present in the Articles of Confederation.
The Commerce Clause has, over time, proven to be a rather wide avenue for the powers of Congress, hasn't it?
It has. That's, to me, one of the interesting stories about human nature and our inability to foresee where problems will arise. So here are these extremely smart, learned people arguing about the Necessary and Proper Clause and the General Welfare Clause and other aspects of the powers delegated to the central government. But really, there wasn't much argument at all over the Commerce Clause. And that's because the Commerce Clause was intended to be and was drafted as something narrow. The wording is narrow, that Congress can regulate commerce between the states. And the intention there was that states would not be able to put taxes or duties on goods arriving from another state. And Madison saw this as an extension of federal power to regulate international trade. So if one state is selling goods overseas, well, those goods might have to go through another state on their way to the French or to the English, whomever it might be. Well, if that other state could put a tax on those goods, well, that just increases the cost of goods coming from the first state, and they may not be able to get those deals. They may, you know, that will inhibit their their prosperity. And so the idea of the Commerce Clause was to prevent that from happening and keep there from being trade problems between the states. As it happens, and we'll talk about this in a future episode, it has been the great gaping hole through which all of the federal Leviathan, or much of the federal Leviathan, has driven.
Back to the notion of federalism, we've spoken many times about it's a delicate balance. I think someone has even used that term about the Constitution itself. This delicate balance that is between sovereignty of states, individual states, and a useful and truly unifying federal government. Reintroduce us to that idea.
Yes, you're right. It really was a delicate balance. They needed unity among the states, as we've already discussed, and they needed an energetic central government to help things to run smoothly. At the same time, by far the majority view was that states were at least in some way sovereign. And so the balance that was struck is that in its own field, the federal government, whatever is delegated to the federal government, in that field, it is the sovereign. But in every other field, everything not delegated to the federal government, each state is its own sovereign. And so what they had to try to do in the drafting of the Constitution was to figure out exactly what topics, what areas, what fields, if you will, needed federal oversight, needed this central unifying authority, and to try to limit what they were drafting to those things so that everything else remains with the states.
That raises a question that I think has been kind of bedeviled the United States for at least the last century, if not longer. And that is with respect to Article II and the Office of the President. It's hard to imagine that the framers pictured the executive branch being as extensive in terms of federal regulation as it has become. The president runs the biggest branch and the most impactful on your daily life kind of branch of government. And we have seen with president after president a willingness to simply, and I'm talking here about executive orders, use this kind of extra constitutional authority that the presidency has assumed to get things done without any real check or balance, at least initially, from the other branches of government. Many have said this is just contrary to the idea of federalism altogether. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I agree. I think it's contrary to federalism, the separation of powers, and really everything that the founders wanted in place. Around the beginning of the 20th century, the progressives, and that's a term that should not really be used, I don't mean that term in the same sense as modern day progressives, today's progressives. So these are, you know, the Teddy Roosevelts, the Woodrow Wilsons, etc. So the in the progressive era, those progressives began to view the Constitution as outdated, and therefore they began to view things like checks on executive power as outdated. They believed that they could scientifically manage things through this executive branch. And so that's when executive power began to burgeon bit by bit through, well, really up until today. And it's an example of Lord Acton's phrase that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The more power the presidency has, the more power each successive president wants. And as we, the people, have become less and less knowledgeable about our founding and less accepting of the principles behind the founding, we tend to cheer our own. So during the presidency of Barack Obama, we had people on the left cheering him as he vowed to, you know, if Congress won't pass a law on this, then I'll do it myself, not pass a law, but take care of it by executive order. And the people on the right were crying foul. But now with the presidency of Donald Trump, he makes similar promises, and the people on the right are cheering him. And as a constitutionalist, I'm not cheering any of it. I really don't want that kind of power in one office.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. It's part three of our series with him on the U.S. Constitution, talking about enumerated powers, federalism, and the Bill of Rights. When we come back, a few more thoughts on executive orders. Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer is the author of our book of the month for October, Reading Isaiah with Luther. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Learn how the conscience is a gift from God and how only through Christ can you receive a clean conscience in Reading Isaiah with Luther, the Issues Etc. book of the month, Reading Isaiah with Luther.
This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we are committed to our Lutheran confession and heritage. Please encourage the student in your life to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Duluth, Minnesota would like to invite you to join us Sunday mornings at 9:30. Whether you are visiting our beautiful city or live here, we have liturgical worship that shares Jesus with you. We're easy to find at 20th Avenue East and Superior Street, and also offer Bible classes at 8:25 Sunday mornings with Sunday school September through May. Check out our website for other Bible study times, visit or call 218-724-2500.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Quality, quantity, qualified. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I'm delighted to be chairman of Preach the Word Project, a project of our Synod to strengthen the preaching of all of us pastors in the Synod. We know how eternally important that is.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Fekencher talking about the new Preach the Word Project.
So we've put together a program of 12 modules that will be coming out this year and over the next 3 years on a variety of preaching topics for pastors to do together with two other pastors, two guys they trust, two guys they feel comfortable with, written materials and very fine video quality materials that are now becoming available.
Preach the Word helps pastors work together to improve their preaching with several resources and by interacting with seminary professors and fellow preachers. Find out more at lcms.org/preachtheword. lcms.org/preachtheword. Preaching is challenging business. We all can use some fresh ideas. lcms.org/preachtheword. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Russell Don is our guest. We're talking to him about the U.S. Constitution in this series, and today it's enumerated powers, federalism, and the Bill of Rights. Before the break, Dr. Don, we were talking about executive orders, this kind of extra constitutional power that the presidency has assumed, and it's been used with great flourish by some presidents. We should note, as a matter of history, that FDR almost governed through executive order. Thousands and thousands were signed during his long tenure as president, albeit, at least for part of that tenure, during a time of war.
Right. A time of war in the later years, a time of severe economic crisis in the early years. And of course, economists argue over the extent to which all of these executive orders further deepened and prolonged the Great Depression. We needn't go down that road, but in terms of constitutional governance, Roosevelt really wasn't that interested in it. He was very much interested in doing what he believed was best for the country, and really he had the mandate of the people to do so, and he took advantage of it.
Let's talk about the Bill of Rights, which this is the part that I think people misunderstand most about the Constitution. They say, okay, here's the Constitution. Why did they almost immediately need to amend it with the Bill of Rights?
Well, that's actually one of my favorite stories about the founding era, because it's an example of good statesmanship, really. The Federalists, such as James Madison, did not believe that a Bill of Rights was needed. And the reason for that, they argued, is that the federal government had enumerated powers, and it had no other powers granted to it. Anti-Federalists argued, well, the federal government could quarter soldiers in our homes, or could take away our arms, our armaments. The Federalists argued back, no, actually, there's nothing in this Constitution giving them the power to do that, so therefore they can't do that. The Anti-Federalists saw that as putting a little bit too much faith in the piece of paper, so they wanted a little bit more on the piece of paper. That, you know, you've not enumerated those powers, but powers tend to expand. And on this point, they were right. Powers do tend to expand, as we've seen. So the Constitution had been drafted and was put to the various states for their ratification. And at the convention of delegates in Virginia, who were determining whether Virginia would vote to ratify the Constitution, there were very strong arguments between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And Madison eventually made a statesmanlike promise, essentially. He said he would run for the House of Representatives in the first election under the new Constitution. And once in the House of Representatives, he would propose a Bill of Rights. And he said, I will do all this if we ratify the Constitution. So you vote now to ratify the Constitution, and I promise a year from now to put a Bill of Rights forward for Congress to propose to the various states. And that agreement worked. The other delegates, the Anti-Federalist delegates in Virginia, eventually came to trust Madison on that. And then Madison followed through. He did get elected to the House of Representatives, and he did, actually, it was while he was running for the House that he put together a list of amendments. Then he won election and proposed those amendments. Well, he proposed 12 amendments, and 10 of them became our Bill of Rights.
So essentially, it was a tip of the hat to the Anti-Federalists that after we get this thing in place, then we will make sure your concerns are addressed with respect to the things that need to be narrowed for the federal government.
That's right. And so we have the Anti-Federalists to thank for the Bill of Rights, because they said the enumeration of powers isn't enough. We need basically negative statements. We need statements that say, yes, the government can do those things, but it cannot do any of these things. Scholars debate to this day whether Madison ever truly believed in the Bill of Rights, but I think there's enough evidence in some of his letters to indicate that he did believe, in the end, he did come to believe that the Anti-Federalists were right, that a Bill of Rights was necessary.
It's kind of crazy because the Bill of Rights has come to, in many ways, embody what the Constitution is for most Americans.
Yes. What many of us don't appreciate is that the Bill of Rights by itself would not be all that helpful. If we did not have separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism, all these ways of having people check the power of other people, people in government, so representatives, senators, presidents, judges, checking the power of one another, without that in place, then the Bill of Rights would be pretty meaningless, because there'd be no way to stop whoever had the power from violating the Bill of Rights.
Where did they get the ideas that are embodied in the Bill of Rights? I know that there's a lot of stuff covered there. Was this the first time that such an amendment to a constitution or something like that had been envisioned, where the government's told repeatedly in article after article, you can't do this, you can't do this? There are basic freedoms that are ensured to every citizen.
Right. The answer to that is no. It was not new at the time of the Constitution. It was, in fact, quite old. The Magna Carta is, in effect, a statement of rights that the king could not infringe upon, and that dates back to 1215. Then in 1689, after the Glorious Revolution and a brief history of that, the British people were laboring under what they viewed as a tyrannous government under King James II. And so certain nobles invited William of Orange to come and try to set things right. And so this is the Glorious Revolution, which was nearly bloodless. And it resulted in the overthrow of King James II and the bringing of William and Mary to the throne. As part of the condition of their coming to the throne, they had to sign off on a Bill of Rights, known now as the English Bill of Rights. Some of the rights in our Bill of Rights come from that English Bill of Rights. For instance, the right to keep and bear arms comes from the English Bill of Rights of 1689. In addition, the state constitutions, which had been drafted over the preceding decade plus before the Constitution, or right around a decade, those constitutions, many of them, had bills of rights. And so really, Madison had a great pool of information from which to draw as he put together his Bill of Rights.
Were they thinking about this, do you know, even prior to ratification, were they putting together amendments that they thought would be necessary after ratification?
Yes. Some wanted to just change the Constitution before it became the Constitution. Well, we'll ratify after we get these amendments put in place. But that was pretty much a non-starter because the delegates, you know, who had drafted the Constitution knew how difficult it was to come up with the thing that they had. To go back, reopen the whole can of worms, probably would have resulted in failure. So that's why Madison wanted to make the deal that he did. You pass this, and then we'll take care of the amendment process.
I'm curious about that because it strikes me that they're working on these things. They know these things need to be fixed. They know that they're going to fix them almost immediately, but they're not really, at least in the first 10 amendments, they're not really changing anything. We think of amendment as taking out a clause and superseding it with another one. They weren't really doing that, were they?
Well, in the end, no, but there was discussion in the House of Representatives about whether these amendments should be made in an interlinear fashion, in other words, just written into the main body of the document, or if they should be tacked on at the end. Ultimately, the latter is the way that they went.
And we should say at this point, none of this could possibly have been possible had not the original Constitution provided for a really rather robust amendment process.
Yes, a very difficult amendment process. It has been amended 27 times, 10 in the first go around. With the degree of partisanship that has marked American politics, not just in recent years, but through much of its history, the amendment process set forth in the Constitution is a very big hurdle to overcome. Two-thirds of each House of Congress plus three-fourths of the states have to approve of an amendment in order for it to become part of the Constitution. If anything, perhaps that process should have been a little less robust, maybe not quite so high of a hurdle. That's a debatable point, but it's possible anyway that the Supreme Court would be less inclined to redraft the Constitution if it were easier for we the people to do so through the amendment process. But again, it's a very debatable point.
One more question before we get into the content of the Bill of Rights. Is there any indication that the framers and the ratifiers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights viewed the first 10 as, in essence, irrevocable? That is, we are setting these down right away as amendments to the Constitution, and we do not conceive of a time when, say, the First Amendment could ever itself be amended or overturned. I mean, I guess the reason I'm asking that is it's come to be known as a Bill of Rights, and it's hard for me to imagine the framers saying, but these rights can be amended away. Freedom
right.
of speech could be amended away permanently from the Constitution if the future deems it necessary.
Right. I agree with you that that was not their conception. They believed that these were embodiments of fundamental rights, of human rights, if you will. Natural rights is perhaps a better word. And to a great extent, I think that they're correct on that whether in a matter of substance or procedure, and we'll get to that distinction in a moment, these things embody what is needed to protect people's natural rights from the impositions of government.
We're talking about the Bill of Rights in our series on the U.S. Constitution. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. If you're enjoying our series with Dr. Dawn, be sure to attend the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation will be making the case for our first freedoms. Attendance is limited to 400. Child care is free thanks to Wittenberg Academy, an online classical Lutheran school. You'll find a conference schedule and you can register at issuesetc.org or give us a call at Lutheran Public Radio 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas. When we come back, we'll get into the contents of the Bill of Rights. A little outline of it is next.
October is Pastor Appreciation Month, and to mark the occasion, the Lutheran Witness is tackling ministry and mental health. Some articles focus on life in the ministry, others deal with emotional wellness generally, still others, including what are perhaps the most powerful pieces of writing in this power-packed issue, grapple with the complicated and often thorny relationship between the two. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. We're doing a series with him on the U.S. Constitution. We've been talking about enumerated powers and federalism. Now we're turning to the contents of the Bill of Rights. Dr. Dawn, how would you divide the Bill of Rights up in terms of its contents?
Well, they can be divided according to substance and procedure, at least roughly divided that way. And there's some gray at the margins on those. So, for instance, substantive rights would include the First Amendment, religion, speech, press, assembly, petitioning, the Second Amendment, the right to keep arms for our self-defense, the Third Amendment, no quartering of soldiers. These are substantive rights, not having strangers in our homes eating our food and being a risk to our wives and daughters, defending ourselves and speaking our minds as a self-governing people. These are substantive rights. Many of the rights, in fact, a majority of them, are, at least in some sense, procedural rights. And this is something that I think we've lost to some extent in the modern era, that a lot of what is fundamentally true in terms of tyrannous government is that tyranny takes away our procedures, the things that can allow us to defend ourselves. So, for instance, the Fourth Amendment says that there would be no unreasonable searches and seizures. The Fifth Amendment says, for instance, that we have a right to indictment, which sounds kind of funny. Who would want to be indicted? But that's basically saying that we have a right to not be accused without an indictment, that we get to know what we're charged with, what the evidence against us is. No double jeopardy, meaning we cannot be tried for the same crime twice. If I'm charged with murder and then I'm acquitted, well, the government doesn't get a second bite at the apple and hoping just for a better jury this time so they can string me up. These procedural rights protect us from kangaroo courts, from a complete lack of justice. The Sixth Amendment, we have the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. So that's procedural. That's not saying that I have a right to life and liberty. It's saying this is how a person's right to life and liberty will be protected. And that's true going through the Seventh Amendment and the Eighth Amendment as well. There is some, as I say, at the margins. So for instance, the Eighth Amendment, no excessive bail or fines, and no cruel and unusual punishment. Well, that's sort of a hybrid substantive procedural, but the basic breakdown is clear enough. And then finally, the last two amendments, the Ninth and Tenth, are essentially allocations of power and rights. So the Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration of rights that has just gone before, so amendments 1 through 8, doesn't mean that those are our only rights. There are other rights. The central government still can't do anything other than what has been delegated to it, and all other things are our rights or the rights of the states. So the enumeration is not meant to be exclusive. There could be other rights. And then the 10th Amendment, powers not delegated to the federal government are retained by the states or by the people.
Why do you think the first two amendments, all of them have been controversial at various times throughout the history of the United States? You're a country long enough, you're going to revisit every one of these issues. But why do you think the first two, at least in the 20th and 21st century, have grown so controversial?
That's a great question. I think it has to do with the pace of change in particular viewpoints. So the procedural rights have been viewed as sacred, if you will, at least in a civil sense, down almost to the current day. Basically, whether you're from the left or the right, you want your procedural rights. You don't want to be hanged after a kangaroo court. Our views of those procedures has changed far more slowly. It's beginning to change now a bit, but I'm not even sure that it will take hold, that those changes will take hold for very long. I'm hopeful that we will continue to emphasize our procedural rights. But the substantive rights, religion, speech, press, self-defense, our views on these things have changed very rapidly in the last 100 years as religion has become less and less central in public life and also in the private lives of citizens. The idea that religion should be protected is becoming more and more controversial. And so that change has taken place far sooner than any change on the procedural side. Our view of guns. Now, we have, you know, police and standing army. We have all of these institutions that we didn't have 200 plus years ago. And so there's a perception that we don't really need to protect ourselves. And we've become so accustomed to non-tyrannous government, to just government, at least relatively speaking, that a lot of people have lost the notion that we need to protect ourselves from our own government. And so with that in mind, really, what's the purpose of a private citizen owning a gun, and especially a handgun, because who goes hunting with a handgun? And so it really comes down to, oh, you want the right to hunt, which really isn't what the Second Amendment is primarily about or is even about.
Yeah, we should point out that hunting was going to the grocery store for a lot of Americans. Yes. When the Constitution was ratified. So I was unaware of the fact that Madison's original text when he wrote the Bill of Rights contained more amendments than the 10 that eventually got passed. It underwent quite a whittling process.
Yes, it did. And there was, just like in any other legislative process in America, there's back and forth between House and Senate. And there, you know, there's first discussion within the House and within a committee within the House. And then it goes before the full House. And then it goes over to the Senate. And there's a lot of back and forth. And they came up with 12 that the Congress proposed, two-thirds of each House proposed these 12 to the states. The states then ratified 10 of them. And the first two were the ones that were not ratified. So the First Amendment originally laid out plans for how representation would be allocated as the population changed. And that amendment didn't get passed. And then the second was essentially what the 27th Amendment is today. In fact, other than a couple of commas, the wording is identical. The text is identical. If Congress passes a law changing its own compensation, that law does not take effect until an intervening election of representatives. So basically, they can't vote themselves a raise that would take effect before the people get to throw the bums out on their ears if they view that raise as unwarranted.
So let's back away and talk about the applicability of the Bill of Rights and of the ratified Constitution. You say at the time these Bill of Rights were not intended to apply so as to limit state power. What does that mean?
It means that the Bill of Rights was aimed at limiting federal power, and it really had nothing to do with the states. So, for instance, looking at the first clause or clauses of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That speaks specifically to Congress. And notice the word respecting. It doesn't say creating. Congress shall make no law creating an establishment of religion. It says having to do with. That's what respecting means. Congress shall make no law having to do with an establishment of religion. So Congress can't make a national religion, nor can Congress interfere with any existing state-level religions, which there were a few at the time. And in fact, Massachusetts had an established religion into the 1830s. Theirs was the last to be overturned. So what was deemed as a right as against the federal government was not necessarily deemed a right as against the various state governments.
That's really an interesting point, that Massachusetts, if you went into the state of Massachusetts, there was an established religion, but the federal constitution said the federal Congress could not do that very thing that it still permitted Massachusetts or other states to do.
That's right. There was, if you will, a view of competition and voting with one's feet. Let the states govern their people as they see fit. If those states do a poor job of it, well, then people can either change who's in office within the state or move somewhere else.
Do you think they foresaw a kind of an influence of the Bill of Rights trickling down to the states in the future?
Not really, no. It's really the Civil War amendments, the post-Civil War amendments that began to change that, and we'll be talking about that in a future week. But the states were viewed as, and actually were, closer to the people. So when I say people could vote with their feet, really the much more prominent method was to go talk to one's state-level representatives and to petition their state-level government, because they could, because they might have actually known, you know, their representative, and the population was not so massive. And so with that, each state could govern as that state's people saw fit.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk about if Madison hadn't been cornered into that promise, would we have had a Bill of Rights in any case, after we conclude our conversation with Dr. Russell Dawn, an hour or two of Issues Etc., we will respond to listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. And then Heather Roush will join us. We'll talk about a culture of sexual integrity. She's author of a new book called Sexuality Mentality, Creating a Culture of Biblical Integrity. That's hour two of Issues Etc. up next.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as His baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
Can you remain a Christian if you stay away from church on Sunday mornings? I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled, Why Do You Go to Church? We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Mark Seifried writes about his journey from being a Baptist seminary professor to becoming a Lutheran seminary professor. It's the free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. On this Wednesday, October the 10th, we are in part three of a series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn, talking about the Bill of Rights. Dr. Dawn, if we discussed earlier about how Madison had essentially made this promise, if you ratify this, then we will amend it to include something like the Bill of Rights. If Madison hadn't been cornered, so to speak, into that promise, would we have still gotten a Bill of Rights in any case?
Yes, had the Constitution survived and become our Constitution, I still believe there would have been a Bill of Rights. It would not have taken long before someone in office infringed on what people commonly viewed as their rights, and I think that would have led to an outcry that would have created a Bill of Rights.
Finally then, Dr. Dawn, I mean, given we're looking at these things in both their nascent and then their pristine form, as they were first ratified by the various states, would those people who spent so much of their time and energy thinking about these things, writing about these things, and I'm talking about not just the framers, but also the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, do you think they'd recognize, not in terms of technology or any of that, would they recognize the political system as it has evolved in the United States today?
No, they simply wouldn't. And in fact, I sometimes wonder if they would have put their heads in their hands and declared to themselves that they had failed. If this is what has come of this Constitution, then the Constitution was a failure. But that's really an unfair standard to collapse the time from then to now. I mean, I'm not saying it's an unfair question. Like I said, it's one that I wonder about. But really, it has been a very gradual process. And for a long time, the Constitution was very successful. And to a pretty great extent, it is still successful. The impositions of the executive branch are great, but they are still not tyrannous. We still are able to curb executive power, and we do so. And we're still able to, even though the rancor and the way that we fight about things in the political sphere now are not necessarily healthy, we do have a lively separation of powers and checks and balances. There's a reason that the Kavanaugh hearings went down the way they did. The Democrats wanted to delay so that there would be this blue wave election in the midterm election, and then Kavanaugh would not be confirmed. And therefore, the executive branch would have to nominate someone to the court who is more moderate. This is checks and balances. And so really, although the process isn't working in many ways, it's still working somewhat, and power is curbed. And we can be thankful for that.
I guess with that said, we use this term constitutional crisis, and I think it's just thrown around rather easily. But anything you see in the political landscape of today, as rancorous as it is, rise to the level of a genuine constitutional crisis where the thing itself or a major part of it is actually at stake?
That's a good question. The best answer to that is not in large ways. I don't think that we are actually experiencing the kind of constitutional crisis that could lead to the downfall of the Constitution, if you will. We do see small things. I think this entire governance by executive order is a small form of constitutional crisis, because what we have there is the executive branch overstepping its boundaries, and then the question is whether Congress will push back. Congress generally doesn't push back, or if it does so by, you know, legislating around it, but it doesn't do things like refuse to fund whatever it is that the president has passed by executive order. So these are small constitutional crises that never get resolved, and we just move on. But in terms of a large one that is putting the republic at risk governmentally, no.
Dr. Russell Dawn is associate professor of history and political thought and director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, thank you very much.
Pleasure is mine, Todd.
On the other side of the break, we're going to be going through your listener email. That email address, always open for you, talkback@issuesetc.org. And the Issues Etc. listener comment line, always open for you, 618-223-8382. Then we'll round everything off today talking with Heather Roush, author of the book Sexuality Mentality, Creating a Culture of Biblical Integrity, about a culture of sexual integrity. Stay tuned.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM or give us a call at our office. We're here to help.
Life in the ministry can be very blessed and very, very hard. It's well known that church workers experience high rates of burnout, depression, and mental illness. But why? And what can be done about it? Join Beverly Yonke, Todd Peppercorn, Heidi Gaiman, and others as they explore answers to tough questions about the ministry and mental health in the October issue of The Lutheran Witness. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University, Wisconsin is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During October, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Concordia University, Wisconsin. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you. Good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.